sadly at everyone around her. I'm a woman myself, so I take the word rape very seriously. Very, very seriously. And that's why I think we need to raise our children to understand that that's not the sort of thing you lie about. And we all know that she's lying, this young woman. The evidence is overwhelmingly in the boy's favor, and there's not a shred of a reason for him to have done what he's accused of. We don't wish to harm the young woman. We don't wish her family ill. But what sort of signal does it send if we don't put our foot down here? That all girls can cry rape the minute their affections aren't reciprocated? I'm a woman myself, and that's why I take this very seriously. Because everyone in here knows that this young woman's father is trying to play politics with it. He clearly couldn't bear the fact that there might be bigger stars on this team than he himself. Peter is standing in the doorway. It takes a few moments for the first person to notice him. Then in a flash, everyone else turns around. A sea of eyes he has known his whole life. Childhood friends, schoolmates, teenage crushes, colleagues, neighbors, parents of children his children play with. At the back, along one wall, their very presence exuding menace, stand 2 dozen young men in black jackets. They're not saying anything, but not one of them takes his eyes off Peter. Peter feels their hatred, but he stands there, defiantly straight-backed, as he looks at Magan Lit. "Please, don't let me interrupt," he says. The room is silent enough for everyone to hear when his heart breaks. The journalist and photographer will talk to the editor-in-chief when they get back to the newsroom. The journalist will expect the editor-in-chief to send them straight back to the meeting, but instead he will mumble something along the lines of, "I don't know if we can really call it threatening. People are just nervous. We have to understand that. Maybe we shouldn't, you know." The photographer will clear his throat and suggest, "Look for problems where there aren't any." The editor-in-chief will nod and say, "Exactly." The journalist won't say anything then. She's too young, too concerned about her job, but she will remember the fear in their eyes. And for a long time afterward, she will find it hard not to think of what Kevin Erdahl said to her when she interviewed him after the semifinal. What all sportsmen learn to say when a teammate has done something wrong. The feigned surprise, the stiff body language, the abrupt response. "What? No, I didn't see that incident." Fatima doesn't knock on her son's door on this occasion, as she always does. When she walks in, Ahmed is sitting on his bed with a business card in his hands. She perches next to him and declares firmly, "A boy is allowed to have secrets from his mother, but not if he's this bad at hiding them." "It's nothing. You don't need..." "Don't worry, Mom," he replies. "Your father would have..." she begins, but he interrupts her. He never does that. "Don't tell me what Dad would have done. He isn't here." She keeps her hands in her lap. He's breathing hard. He tries to hand her the business card. She doesn't take it. "It's a job," he manages to say, somewhere between a boy's hopefulness and a young man's anger. "I've got a job. A better job," he says. His mother raises her eyebrows in surprise. "Oh? Is it a job where they have an indoor rink so I can see my son practice every day?" His shoulders sink. "No." "Then it isn't a better job for me. I have a job. Don't worry about me." His eyes flash. "So who is, Mom? Look around. Who's going to take care of us when your back can't take any more?" "I will. Just like I always have," she promises. He tries to press the business card into her hand, but she refuses. He cries, "You're nothing if you're alone in this world, Mom." She doesn't answer, just sits beside him until he starts to cry. He sobs. "It's too hard, Mom. You don't understand how much I can't." Fatima removes her hands from his, stands up, backs away, and says sternly, "I don't know what you know, but whatever it is, there's clearly someone out there who's terrified that you're going to reveal it. And let me tell you something, my darling boy. I don't need any men. I don't need a man to drive me in a big car to the rink each morning, and I don't need a man to give me a new job that I don't want. I don't need a man to pay my bills, and I don't need a man to tell me what I can think and feel and believe. I only need one man, my son. And you're not alone. You've never been alone. You just need to be better at choosing the company you keep. She leaves him, closes the door behind her. Doesn't take the business card. Magan Lit is still on her feet, too proud to back down now. She turns to the board and demands, I think we should have an open vote. The club's president addresses the whole meeting. Well, I feel obliged to point out that according to the statutes, it is within the rights of anyone here to demand a secret ballot. He realizes too late that this is precisely what Magan is after. She turns to the room and asks, I see. Is there anyone in here who isn't prepared to stand by their opinion? Who can't look the rest of us in the eye and say what they think? By all means, stand up and ask to be allowed to vote anonymously. No one moves. Peter turns and leaves. He could have stayed to defend himself, but he chooses not to. Ahmet puts his headphones in his ears, walks through his own neighborhood and the rest of the town, passes his whole childhood, a whole life. There will always be people who won't understand his decision, who will call him weak or dishonest or disloyal. They are probably people who live secure lives, who are surrounded by people who share their own opinions and only talk to people who reinforce their own worldview. It's easy for them to judge him. It's always easier to lecture other people about morality when you've never had to answer for anything yourself. He goes to the rink, joins his teammates. He may have left his war-torn country before he could talk, but he has never stopped being a refugee. Hockey is the only thing that has ever made him feel like part of a group. Normal. Good at something. William Litt slaps him on the back. Ahmet looks him in the eye. Ramona is standing in the hallway, waiting for Peter, leaning on a stick, smelling of whiskey. It's the first time in a decade that he's seen her more than 5 paces outside the bearskin. She grunts at him. They'll feel ashamed in the end. One day they'll remember that when the word of a boy was set against that of a girl, they believed the boy blindly. And then they'll feel ashamed. Peter pats her on the shoulder. No one's asking. No one. You don't have to get involved in this just for my family's sake, Ramona, he whispers. And you can fuck off if you're going to tell me what I can and can't do, boy. He nods, kisses her cheek, and leaves. He's reached his car by the time she opens the door to the cafeteria with her stick. One of the men on the board, dressed in a suit, is just loosening his tie and says, possibly as a joke, possibly not, how on earth could it have happened, anyway? Has anyone asked themselves that? Have you seen the jeans those young women wear these days? Tight as snakeskin. They can hardly take them off themselves, so what chance would a teenage boy have if she didn't want him to, eh? He laughs at his own wit. A few others join in. But the bang when the door flies open silences the whole room as everyone turns around. Ramona is standing there, drunk and furious, pointing at him with her stick. Really, little Leonard? That's what you're wondering? Shall we have a bet, your annual salary, perhaps, that I could get that whole suit off you against your will without a single bugger in here doing a damn thing about it? She slams her stick down in drunken rage on the back of a chair, making the perfectly innocent man sitting on it gasp for breath and clutch his chest. Ramona shakes her stick at them all. This isn't my town. You're not my town. You should be ashamed of yourselves. One man stands up and shouts, Shut up, Ramona! You don't know anything about this! 3 men in black jackets step silently out of the shadows by the wall. One of them takes several strides across the room, stops in front of the man, and says, If you tell her to shut up again, I'll shut you up. For good. Ahmet stands outside the rink, looking his teammates in the eyes. Then he takes a deep breath, turns away from them, and starts walking. His first step is hesitant, the second more confident. He hears Lit start shouting behind him, but carries on into the rink, not bothering to close the door behind him. He walks past the ice, up the stairs, into the cafeteria, forcing his way between the rows of chairs, stops in front of the board, and looks each and every man and woman in there in the eye. A man named Erdal, first of all, and longest of all. "My name is Amit. I saw what Kevin did to Maya. I was drunk. I'm in love with her, and I'm telling you that straight so that you lying bastards don't have to say it behind my back when I walk out of here. Kevin Erdal raped Maya Anderson. I'm going to go to the police tomorrow, and they'll say I'm not a reliable witness. But I'm going to tell you everything now, everything that Kevin did, everything that I saw, and you won't ever forget it. You know that my eyes work better than anyone else's in here, because that's the first thing you learn on the Beartown Ice Hockey Club, isn't it? You can't teach that way of seeing. That's something you're born with." Then he tells them every detail, everything that was in Kevin's room, the posters on the wall, the exact arrangement of trophies on the shelves, the scratches on the floor, the color of the bedclothes, the blood on the boy's hand, the terror on the girl's face, the muffled screams stifled beneath a heavy palm, the bruises, the violence, the incomprehensible, hideous, unforgivable nature of it all. He tells them everything, and no one in the room will ever forget it. When he's finished, he leaves them. He doesn't slam the door, doesn't stomp down the stairs, doesn't shout at anyone on the way out. William launches himself at him the moment he reaches the parking lot. "What have you done? What have you done, you fucking stupid little bitch? What have you done?" The hands that push between them are half the size of Lit's, actually even smaller than Amit's, but they keep the boys apart as if they possessed infinite strength. "That's enough!" Aunt Katrine roars at William. Bobo is standing a couple of yards away, watching his mother stare down a young man twice her size. He's never felt more stupid. Never felt prouder. Inside the cafeteria, Philip's mother stands up, waits until the noise has died down, claps two damp palms together, looks at the board and says, "Can anyone demand that we vote anonymously?" The president nods. "Secret ballot. Of course. According to the statutes, one person requesting it is enough."
"Then I request it,"
Philip's mother says and sits down. Her best friend is sitting beside her and tugs at her arm with insulted outrage. "What are you doing? What are you do?" And then Philip's mother says three little words that all best friends have to say to each other occasionally. "Shut up, Magan." Amit backs away without looking at his former teammates. Knows what they're thinking anyway. He puts his headphones in, casts a last glance inside the rink, sees the ice shimmering beneath a single fluorescent light. He knows he's put himself on the losing side. He'll never win this. Maybe he'll never get to play again. If anyone had asked him there and then if it was worth it, he would have whispered, "I don't know." Sometimes life doesn't let you choose your battles. Just the company you keep. He walks back through the town. There's snow on the ground, but the air smells of spring. He's always hated this time of year because it means that the hockey season is over. He has walked nearly all the way home when he turns into the stairwell next to his, climbs to the third floor, and rings the doorbell. Zacharias is clutching a video game handset when he opens the door. They look at each other until the snow melts around Amit's shoes. He's breathing heavily, can feel his pulse in his ears. "Happy birthday." Zacharias steps back into the hall so he can come in. Amit hangs his jacket on the same hook where he's hung it every day since he was old enough to reach up there himself. Zacharias is sitting on the bed in his room, playing a video game. Amit sits next to him for half an hour. Then Zacharias gets up, goes over to a shelf, fetches another handset, and puts it in his friend's lap. They play without speaking. They've never needed words. Meanwhile, at a meeting, at a rink, the members of a club vote on the GM's future, but just as much on their town's future. Their own. Everyone's. Ramona is sitting in a corner next to a man in a black jacket. He's got a tattoo of a bear on his neck and is twirling his car keys nervously around his fingers. Ramona pats him on the cheek. You didn't have to threaten to shut him up. I could have managed. But thanks. The man smiles weakly. His knuckles are covered in scars. One of his arms bears the marks of a stab wound, and she's never admired or judged him for that. He and the other men in black jackets grew up at the Bearskin. Ramona has stood by them when everyone else kept their distance. She's defended them even when she hasn't agreed with them. She's had their backs even as she's yelled at them. They love her. But still he says, I'm not sure I can get the guys to vote the way you want here. She nods and scratches his cropped hair. I looked Ahmed in the eye tonight. I trust him. And I'm going to act accordingly. How you choose to act is up to you. It always has been. The man nods. The tattoo on his neck moves up and down as he swallows. I don't know if we can get involved in this. The pack and the team have to come first. Ramona gets slowly to her feet, but before she goes to cast her vote, she pats him on the knee and asks, "Whose club is it?" The man sits and watches her go, twirls his car keys around his fingers. The Saab logo on them appears and disappears from his palm. Then his eyes wander across the room to a man sitting on a chair in the very front row. He saw him in the hollow, together with Ahmet, Kevin Erdahl's father. The man in the black jacket puts his hand in his pocket. He still has the 5 crumpled 1,000-kroner notes there, the ones he picked out of the snow. He still hasn't decided what he's going to do with them. Chapter 44. The love a parent feels for a child is strange. There is a starting point to our love for everyone else, but not this person. This one we have always loved. We loved them before they even existed. No matter how well prepared they are, all moms and dads experience a moment of total shock when the tidal wave of feelings first washes through them, knocking them off their feet. It's incomprehensible because there's nothing to compare it to. It's like trying to describe sand between your toes or snowflakes on your tongue to someone who's lived their whole life in a dark room. It sends the soul flying. David rests his hand on his girlfriend's stomach, aware that his whole life is being taken over by love for someone he's never met. His mom always said that every child is like a heart transplant. He understands that now. His girlfriend's fingers stroke the back of his neck. He spent all evening talking on the phone, finding out about the meeting, the decisions. He's received an offer he's been dreaming of ever since he started coaching the Little League team. I don't know what to do. You have to trust your heart, his girlfriend says. I'm a hockey coach. That's all I want to be. The rest is politics. It's got nothing to do with sports. His girlfriend kisses his hand. So be a hockey coach, then. Maya rings Anna's doorbell. She says nothing about Kevin on the jogging track, nothing about anything at all. Not long ago, the idea of keeping secrets from Anna was unthinkable, and now it's perfectly natural. It's a terrible feeling. They go back to Maya's house. Peter, Kira, and Leo are sitting in the kitchen. They're waiting for their phones to ring, for someone to tell them how everything went at the meeting. But so far, all is quiet. So they do the only thing they can do. Maya fetches her guitar, Peter gets his drumsticks, Anna asks if she can sing. She's a terrible singer. She sings so badly that it helps the whole family put up with the wait. In another part of town, in a rink on the way down to the lake, a meeting of the members of a hockey club is coming to an end. A vote has come to an end. The results have been counted. Everyone is dealing with the consequences. A group of men in black jackets are scattered throughout the gathering, some with their families, others alone. Men and women disappear into the parking lot. Everyone is talking, but no one is saying anything. It's going to be a long night in houses where all the lights are off, but all the people are awake. The club's president remains seated at the table in the cafeteria long after everyone has left. Tails is standing alone in the darkness out in the sands. This club is their lives. Neither of them knows who it belongs to now. Amit is sitting on Zacharias' bed when his phone buzzes. A single text, a single word, from Maya. "Thanks," Amit replies with a single word. "Sorry." The thanks is for what he has done. The apology is for how long it took him to summon the courage to do it. Kevin's parents are the first to leave the meeting. His dad shakes a few hands, exchanges a few brief words. His mom says nothing. They get in separate cars, drive in different directions. Soon goes home, feeds the puppy. When the phone rings, he is both surprised and not remotely surprised. It's the president of a hockey club. Soon stays up after he ends the call. Suspects he'll soon be getting a visitor. Kevin's mom stops her car, switches the engine off, but contemplates switching it straight back on again. She turns the headlights off, but doesn't move. Her body has no energy. She feels feverish, can hardly grip the wheel with her fingers. Her insides have burned to ash. Her body is just a shell. That's how she'll remember feeling. She gets out of the car, walks into the residential area, finds the right row house, and rings the doorbell. It's the last building before the hollow. The puppy hears the visitor before the knock on the door. Soon opens up and tries to tell the little creature to go away, but his voice doesn't even come close to hiding who already has the power in their relationship. Any difference between hockey players and dogs? David smiles grimly outside. "At least hockey players occasionally do what you tell them," Soon mutters. The two men look at each other. Once upon a time, they were mentor and pupil. Once upon a time, the love between them was unshakable. Times change. "I wanted to come around so you heard this directly from me," David begins. "You've got the A-team job," Soon nods. "The president called?" "Yep." "It's nothing personal, Soon, but I'm a hockey coach. This is what we do." Benji's plastered foot isn't a plastered foot anymore. It's a wooden leg now. He's got a black patch over one eye, his room is a pirate ship, and his sister's children are the enemy. They're fencing with hockey sticks, shrieking with laughter as he chases them around, hopping on one leg. They pull the quilt and sheet off the bed and throw them over his head, making him stumble and nearly pull over an entire chest of drawers. Gabby is standing in the doorway, arms folded, doing her special mom face. "Shit," one of the kids says. "It was mostly Uncle Benji's fault," the other one claims instantly. "Hey, you don't tell on your friends," Benji shouts, trying to crawl out from under the bed linens. Gabby points at her children and says sternly, "You've got 5 minutes to tidy up in here. Then you go and wash your hands and come out and eat dinner. Grandma's nearly ready. And that goes for you too, little brother." Benji grunts beneath the covers. The children help him. Gabby goes into the hall so they can't see how hard she's laughing. Laughter that's sorely needed in this town tonight. Soon draws a deep breath, down to the very depths of his bulky frame. He looks at David. "Do you really hate Peter so much that you couldn't be in the same club if he stayed?" David sighs in frustration. "This has nothing to do with him. I just can't accept what he stands for. This is hockey. We have to be capable of putting the club's best interests ahead of our own." "And you don't think Peter's done that?"
"I saw him, Soon. I saw him in the parking lot when the police took Kevin off the team bus. Peter drove there and watched because he wanted to see it happen. It was revenge."
"Wouldn't you have done the same in his place?" David looks up, shakes his head. "If I was in his place, I'd probably have had a gun with me. That's not what I'm talking about." "So what are you talking about?"
Soon wonders. I'm talking about the fact that hockey only works well if it's in a world of its own. If we don't get all sorts of crap from outside mixed up with it. If Peter's family had waited until the day after the final to report Kevin to the police, he'd still have suffered exactly the same judicial consequences. Police, prosecutor, trial, the whole lot. It would all have happened exactly the same. Just one day later. And Kevin would have been able to play in the final. And maybe the juniors would have won the final. Soon concludes, although evidently without agreeing. David is adamant. That's what justice is, Soon. That's why society has laws. Peter could have waited until after the final, because what Kevin did had nothing to do with hockey. Nothing to do with the club, but Peter chose to impose his own punishment. So he damaged the whole team and the whole club. The whole town. The old man's breath wheezes as it fills his big body. He's old, but his eyes haven't aged. Do you remember, David, just after you got onto the A-team, we had a guy who suffered 3 serious concussions in 2 seasons? Everyone knew that if he got one more, he'd have to stop playing. We came up against a team who had a huge hulk of a guy on defense, and he knew about that. And after the first shift, he purposefully went straight for our guy's head in a hit. I remember, David says. Do you remember what you did to the other guy? I decked him. Yes. Our guy got another concussion. That match was his last. And the referee didn't even give the back a penalty. So you decked the other guy. Because sometimes referees get things wrong. And sometimes there's a difference between breaking the rules and offending morally. And you believed you had the right to impose your own justice out there on the ice. This isn't the same thing, David replies, more confidently than he really feels. Soon thinks for a long time, pats the puppy, scratches his eyebrow. David, do you believe that Kevin raped Maya? David takes an eternity to consider his answer. He's been considering it every second since the police picked Kevin up. He's tried to see it from every angle, and he's ended up trying to be rational, responsible. So he says, "That's not for me to decide. That's up to a court. I'm a hockey coach." Soon looks desolate. "I can respect you, David, but I don't respect that attitude. And I can't respect Peter for playing God with this team and this club and the whole town, just because this is about his daughter. Let me ask you one thing, Soon. If Kevin had been accused of raping a different girl, if it hadn't been Peter's daughter, do you think Peter would have encouraged that girl's family to report him to the police on the day of the final?" Soon leans his head against the doorpost. "Let me ask you something in return, David. What if it wasn't Kevin who was reported to the police? If it had been any other guy? If it had been a guy from the Hollow? Would you still think the same way you do now?" "I don't know," David replies honestly. Soon lets those words sink in, because in the end that's all anyone can ask of another person. That we are prepared to admit that we don't know everything. Soon steps aside and makes space in the hall. "Would you like coffee?" The doorbell of the Anderson family's house rings. It takes a long time before anyone answers. Kira and Leo are playing cards in the kitchen, and an electric guitar and drum set are echoing from the garage. The bell rings again. Eventually, Peter, sweat marks on his shirt and a pair of drumsticks in his hand, opens the door. The club's president is standing outside. "I've got bad news and good news." David and Soon sit opposite each other at the kitchen table. David has never been here before. They've seen each other every day at the rink for almost 15 years, but this is the first time either of them has been inside the other's home. "So, you got your A-team job in the end," Soon says magnanimously. "Just not the one I was expecting," David replies in a subdued voice. Soon pours coffee. After the members' meeting, Soon had certainly been expecting a phone call from a club president, one who had offered David a job as A-team coach. He had just been expecting it to be in Beartown. "Milk?" Soon asks. "No, black is good," replies the new coach of the A-team of the head ice hockey club. The president clears his throat. Kira appears in the hall. Leo and Maya are standing farther back. The little brother takes hold of his big sister's hand.
The members voted. They don't want to fire you, the president says.
His words aren't met with rejoicing, not even a smile. Peter wipes the sweat from his brow.
What does that mean?
The president turns his palms up and slowly shrugs.
David's handed in his notice. He's been offered the job of A-team coach in head. All the best junior players will go with him. Lit, Philip, Benji, Bobo. They don't play for the team, Peter. They never have. They play for David. They'd follow him anywhere. And without them, we can forget all our plans of building up the A-team. Pretty much all the sponsors have called me this evening to cancel their sponsorship deals.
We can sue them, Kira growls. But the president shakes his head.
They put all their money in last year on the understanding that the juniors would become a good A-team. We can forget good now. We won't even be able to pay any wages. I don't even know if we'll actually have a team at all next year.
The council aren't going to invest. They don't want to put the hockey academy here after the scandal.
Peter nods. What about the Erdahl family?
Kevin's dad is withdrawing his money, obviously. Switching it to head instead. He wants to crush us, naturally.
And if Kevin doesn't get convicted in court for everything that's happened, then, well, he'll be playing for head, too. All our best players will follow him.
Peter leans against the wall, smiles sadly.
So, good news and bad news, then. The good news is that you're still GM. The bad is that I'm not sure we're even going to have a club next season for you to be GM of.
He turns to go, but changes his mind. He looks over his shoulder and says,
"And I owe you an apology."
Peter sighs through his nose and shakes his head slowly.
"You don't have to apologize to me. It's..." "You're not the one I'm apologizing to," the president interrupts.
And he gazes past Peter, down the hall, and looks Maya directly in the eye. David holds the cup in both hands, looks down at the table.
"I might sound like a sentimental old woman now, soon, but I want you to know that I appreciate everything you've done for me. Everything you've taught me."
Soon scratches the puppy, fixes his gaze on its fur.
"I should have cut you more slack. I was too proud a lot of the time. I didn't want to admit that the game had grown away from me."
David drinks coffee, looks at the window.
"I'm going to be a dad. It's silly, really, given the circumstances, but I wanted you to be the first to know."
At first, Soon can't get a word out. Then he stands up, opens a cupboard, and returns with a bottle of liquor.
"I think we're going to need stronger coffee."
They drink a toast. David lets out a short laugh, but quickly falls silent.
"I don't know if being a hockey coach makes you a better or a worse dad," he says.
"Well, I think being a dad makes you a better coach," Soon replies. David drinks, puts his empty cup down.
"I can't stay at a club that mixes up hockey and politics. It was you who taught me that."
Soon fills his cup again.
"I don't have any children, David, but do you want to hear my best advice about being a parent?"
"Yes."
"I was wrong."
Good words to know. David smiles weakly and takes a gulp of the drink.
"I can understand you being on Peter's side. He was always your best pupil."
"Second best," Soon corrects him. They don't look at each other. Their eyes are glistening.
Soon exclaims dully, "It's Peter's daughter, David. His daughter. He only wants justice."
David shakes his head.
"No. He doesn't want justice. He wants to win. He wants Kevin's family to feel more pain than his. That's not justice. That's revenge."
Soon fills their cups. They toast with minimal gestures. Drink thoughtfully. Then Soon says,
"Come and see me when your child turns 15. Maybe you'll feel differently then."
David gets to his feet. They part with a firm but short embrace. Tomorrow they will head for different rinks, one in Head and one in Beartown. Next season they will be opponents. Audrey is standing in her mom's kitchen. Katya and Gabby are arguing about setting the table, about which bowls to use, which candles to light. When Benji comes into the kitchen, his mother kisses him on the cheek and tells him she loves him and that he's the light of her life. Then she swears at him about his foot again and informs him that he might as well have broken his neck instead, seeing as he clearly doesn't use his head anyway. The doorbell rings. The woman outside apologizes for disturbing them so late. Her skin looks too big. Her skeleton can barely carry her. She has to spend 10 minutes getting Benji's mother to agree that she really doesn't need to be invited to dinner. But Benji's mother still taps Audrey on the head and hisses, "Get another plate out!" Then Audrey nudges Gabby and whispers, "Get a plate!" Then Gabby kicks Katya and groans, "Plate!" Katya turns to Benji, but stops mid-movement when she sees the expression on his face. Kevin's mother stands in the doorway and manages to say in a voice that is weak and unlike her own, "Sorry, I'd just like a word with Benjamin." Kevin is standing in the garden outside the house, shooting puck after puck after puck. Bang, 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 bang. Inside the house, his dad is sitting with a newly opened bottle of whiskey in front of him. They didn't get everything they wanted this evening, but they haven't lost, either. Tomorrow, their lawyer will start to prepare all the arguments why a drunk young man who is in love with the young woman is not a credible witness. Then Kevin will start playing for Head Ice Hockey, taking his team with him, almost all the sponsors, and all their plans for life will be intact. One day, very soon, everyone around them will simply pretend that this has never happened. Because this family does not lose. Not even when they do. Bang. 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 Benji is sitting on a bench outside his house. Kevin's mom is sitting next to him, leaning her head back and looking at the stars. "I remember that island you used to row out to in summer, you and Kevin," she says. Benji doesn't answer, but he's also thought about that. They found it when they were little. Not in the big lake behind the rink, where everyone from the town goes swimming in the summer. They could never have any peace there. They had to walk for hours through the forest to reach another, smaller lake. There was no dock there, no people, and in the middle of it was a small cluster of rocks and trees that from the water looked like no more than an overgrown jumble of stone blocks. The boys dragged a boat through the forest, rowed out, and cleared the interior of the little island until they had a space big enough for a tent. And that was their secret place. The first summer, they were only there overnight. The second summer, a few days. When they became teenagers, several weeks. Every second that hockey didn't need them, until summer training began. They simply vanished in a puff of smoke and disappeared from town. Swam naked in the lake, dried off in the sun on the rocks. Fished for their meals, slept under the starry sky. Benji looks up at that same sky now. Kevin's mother looks at him intently. "Do you know, Benjamin, I find it so odd that so many people in this town seem to believe that it was my family who looked after you when your dad passed away. Because it was actually the reverse. Kevin has spent more time in your mother's house than you have in ours. I know you used to mess up the house after we'd been away to make it look like Kevin had slept there, but you knew?" Benji nods. She smiles. "I also know that you kick my rugs on purpose to mess up the tassels." "Sorry." She looks at her hands, takes a deep breath. "It was your mom who washed your hockey gear and Kevin's when you were young, who made meals for you both. And when older boys picked on you at school, it was my sisters who showed up and sorted them out. You've got good sisters. I've got three lunatics for sisters. That's a blessing, Benjamin." He blinks slowly, presses his broken foot to the ground so that that pain becomes worse than the other. The woman bites her lip. It's hard for a mother to admit certain things, Benjamin. I noticed that you didn't meet us at the police station. I noticed that you didn't come round to the house, that you didn't go to the meeting this evening. She very quickly puts her forefinger and thumb to her eyes, swallows hard, whispers. Ever since you and Kevin were small, every time the two of you caused any trouble, the teachers and other parents always said it was you who started it, and blamed the fact that you have no male role model. And I've never known what to say to that, because I've never heard anything more stupid in my life. Benjamin glances at her in surprise. She opens her eyes, reaches out her hand, and touches his cheek softly with it. That hockey team. That bloody hockey team. I know you all love each other, how loyal you all are. Sometimes I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. I remember when you made catapults when you were 9 years old and Kevin broke the neighbor's window. Do you remember? You got the blame. Because when all the other boys ran away, you stayed where you were because you realized that someone had to take the blame and that it would be worse for Kevin if he got the blame than it would be for you. Benji wipes his eyes. She's still holding her hand against his cheek. She pats him and smiles. You may not be an angel, Benjamin, I know that much. But dear God, you haven't lacked a role model. All your best qualities come from the fact that you've been raised in a house full of women. She moves closer. The boy's whole body is shaking. She hugs him tight and says, My son has never been able to lie to you, Benjamin, has he? Kevin has been able to lie to everyone in the whole world. To his dad, to me, but never to you. They sit there, her arms around him, for a single minute of their lives. Then Kevin's mom stands up and gets back in her car. Benji tries to light a cigarette. His hands are shaking too much to hold the lighter. His tears extinguish the flame. The dad is still sitting in the kitchen. The whiskey bottle is open, but untouched. Bang, 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 bang. The mom comes home, looks at her husband, stops briefly in the hall, and looks at one of the pictures on the wall. A framed family photograph. It's hanging crookedly. The frame is smashed, and there's glass on the floor. One of the dad's hands is bleeding. The mom says nothing, just sweeps the glass up and disposes of it. Then she goes out into the garden. Bang, 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 bang. When Kevin goes to collect the pucks, she grabs his arm. Not hard, not in anger, just enough to force him to turn around. She looks him in the eye and he lowers his gaze. Her fingers take hold of his chin and force his face up again, so that the son has to look at his mother. Until she knows. This family doesn't lose, but they will know. The Anderson family are sitting in their kitchen, all five, including Anna. They're playing a childish card game. No one's winning because they're all trying to let everyone else win. The doorbell rings again. Peter answers it. He stands there in silence, just staring. Kira follows him, but stops when she sees who it is. Last comes Maya. Kevin's mother stands outside the house, broken, seemingly drowning in her own clothes. Her legs are shaking, struggling until they give way beneath her. They've told her that too much time has passed for the police to use anything as reliable evidence. The girl should have taken photographs. She shouldn't have showered. She should have reported the incident at once. Now it's too late. That's what they said. But the bruises are still visible on the girl's neck and wrists. Kevin's mother can see them. The marks left by strong fingers forcing her, holding her down. Stopping her from screaming. She sinks to her knees at the girl's feet, reaches her hand out as if to touch her, but her trembling arms can't reach. Maya stands there empty for a long time, just looking on. She closes her eyelids, stops breathing. Her skin is mute. Her tear ducts so numb that her body doesn't feel like it's her own. Then, with infinite care, she reaches out her fingers, as if she were picking a lock, and strokes the woman's hair soothingly as she sobs uncontrollably against the girl's legs. "I'm sorry," Kevin's mother whispers. "It isn't your fault," Maya replies. One of them falls. The other starts to climb back up. Chapter 45. Bang. 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 There are few words that are harder to explain than loyalty. It's always regarded as a positive characteristic, because a lot of people would say that many of the best things people do for each other occur precisely because of loyalty. The only problem is that many of the very worst things we do to each other occur because of the same thing. Bang. 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 Ahmet is standing by the window in Zacharias' bedroom and sees the first of them making their way between the buildings, hoods over their heads, their faces hidden behind scarves. Zacharias is in the bathroom. Ahmet could ask him to come out with him, or he could hide here all night. But he knows that the hooded figures out there are looking for him. He knows that more of them are on their way. They stand up for each other. That's what a team is built on. And their hate now isn't about what they believe Kevin has or hasn't done. It's about Ahmet going against the team. They're an army, and they need an enemy. So Ahmet creeps out into the hall and puts his jacket on. He's not going to let Zacharias get beaten up for his sake, and he can't risk anyone trying to break into his mom's apartment in their hunt for him. When Zacharias comes back into the room, his best friend is gone. Out of loyalty. Bang. Bang. Aunt Katrine is standing at the kitchen window when the young men come through the trees, lit at the front, with a further 8 or 9 behind him. Some are from the juniors team, she recognizes them, and a few are older brothers, even bigger. They're all wearing hoodies and dark scarves. They're not a team, not a gang. They're a lynch mob. Bobo goes out into the snow to meet them. Aunt Katrine stands in the window and watches her son stand with his head bowed, while Lit lays his hand on his shoulder, explains the strategy, gives him orders. All his life, Bobo has wanted just one thing, to be allowed to belong to something. His mom watches her boy try to explain something to Lit, but Lit is way beyond reasoning now. He shouts and shoves Bobo, presses his index finger to his forehead, and even from the window, his mother can read the word betrayal on his lips. The young men pull their hoods over their heads, mask themselves with their scarves, disappear among the trees. Aunt Katrine's son is left standing there alone, until he changes his mind. Hogg is bent over an engine when Bobo comes into the garage. His dad half gets up, and father and son glance at each other without either of them properly looking up. The father bends over the engine again without speaking. Bobo fetches a hoodie and a scarf. Bang. Philip is eating dinner with his parents. They don't say much. Philip is the best back on the team. One day, he'll be much more than that. When he was little and hopelessly behind boys the same age as him in every measure of physical development, everyone kept waiting for him to stop playing. But the only thing he never stopped doing was fighting. When he was the weakest on the team, he learned to compensate by reading the game and always being in the right place at the right time. Now he's one of the strongest, and one of the most loyal. He would have been a force to be reckoned with, dressed in a hooded top and a scarf. The restaurant in Head isn't particularly good, but his mother insisted that they come here tonight, right after the meeting, the whole family. They stay until it closes. So when the boys Philip has never been able to say no to if they ask for something, knock on the door of the family's house, Philip, just as he always is in hockey, is in the right place at the right time. Not at home. Bang. Amit shivers in the wind, but stands still beneath one of the streetlights on purpose. He wants them to see him from a distance, so that no one else has to get involved. He will never be able to explain how he dares to do this, but perhaps you get tired of being frightened if you've been frightened long enough. He doesn't know how many there are as they make their way between the buildings, but they look so obviously violent that he knows he won't manage to get a single punch in before they're all over him. His heart is beating in his throat. He doesn't know if they want to scare him, if they want to mark him to make an example out of him, or if perhaps they're seriously planning to make sure he can never play hockey again. One of them is holding something, a baseball bat, perhaps. As they pass the last streetlight before his, a metal pipe glints in another hand. Amit shields himself from the first blow with his lower arm, but the second hits him on the back of the head. Then a flash of pain shoots up his spine as the metal pipe hits him across the thigh. He swipes and bites and drags his way through the horde of bodies, but this isn't a fight, it's an assault. He's already bleeding by the time he hits the snow. Bang. Bobo has never been good at much except fighting. That's something it's easy to be appreciated for when you grow up in the right surroundings. He isn't just strong and disconcertingly resilient. His reaction time is pretty astonishing considering how sluggish and slow he is otherwise. But he's never been very fit. He's too heavy to run long distances, so he's struggling to keep up with the other masked figures without wearing himself out before they get there. He knows he won't have many seconds to show them who he really is, how loyal he can be, how brave, how selfless. They slow down when they see Amit. The 15-year-old is standing alone, waiting for them. "He's got balls, I give him that, for not running and hiding," Lip mutters. When the first blow comes, Amit shields himself with his lower arm, but he doesn't see much after that. Bobo has a couple of seconds in which to step forward from the back and punch Lit just once in the face as hard as he can, knocking his scarf from his face and sending the huge young man's body crashing into a wall. Bobo elbows another guy, one he's played hockey with since they could barely skate, in the nose, making it explode in a shower of blood. He only has those few seconds before his teammates realize what he is. A traitor. Amit is lying on the ground, and Bobo fights like a wild animal, headbutting and kneeing and whirling his hands around like hammers. In the end, he succumbs to their superior numbers and the collective weight of his attackers. Lit sits on his chest and rains down blow after blow after blow, bellowing, "You bitch! You bitch! You lying fucking cowardly little traitor bitch!" into the darkness. Bang. A car stops 20 yards away between the buildings. Someone who evidently doesn't want to get involved, but who still puts the car's headlights on full beam. For a few moments, the whole scene is illuminated. A voice in Lit's ear shouts, "Someone's coming! Let's go! Let's go!" And then they're gone. Some are swearing, some limping, but the boots march off into the night and disappear. Amit lies curled up in the fetal position for a long time, not daring to believe that they've stopped kicking him. Slowly, slowly, he moves his limbs one after the other to check that nothing's broken. He turns his head slightly to one side. It's throbbing with pain. His vision is clouded. But he sees his teammate lying in the snow beside him. "Bobo?" The huge boy's face is as battered as his knuckles. At least a couple of their opponents must have been left barely able to get away under their own steam. They must have helped each other leave. When Bobo opens his mouth, a steady trickle of blood oozes from where there should have been a front tooth. "Are you okay?" Bobo asks. "Yes," Amit groans. Bobo's mouth cracks into a smile. "Again?" Amit snorts. It takes an immense effort for him to hiss. "Again! Again!" Bobo yells. Smiling, they slump back on the ground, wheezing and shaking. "Why? Why help me? Amit whispers. Bobo spits some red slime on the ground.
Well, I'll never get a place in Head's A-team anyway. But Beartown might actually be so bad next season that even I stand a chance.
Amit starts to laugh, but he shouldn't have done that, because only then does he realize that one of his ribs is probably broken. He screams, and Bobo might have laughed at him even louder if his jaw hadn't been so painful.
Bang. Bang. Bang.
The car, a little distance away, a Saab, switches off its headlights. There are two men in black jackets sitting in it. They hesitate for a few moments. It's always hard to know who you can trust in Beartown. But the men in the black jackets have grown up in the Bearskin pub, where loyalty is perhaps prized above all else. And they're violent men. They know how to terrify people. So perhaps they appreciate the courage of someone who knows he's going to get a beating but still doesn't run. So in the end, they get out and walk between the streetlights. Amit squints through swollen eyelids as they lean over him.
Was that you in the car?
He whimpers. They nod almost imperceptibly. Amit tries to sit up.
You saved our lives.
Thanks. One of the men leans closer and says gruffly,
Don't thank us, thank Ramona. Hell, we still don't know if we can trust you, but you could have kept your trap shut at that meeting. You had a fuck of a lot to lose saying what you did about Kevin. And Ramona looked into your eyes. She trusts you. And we trust her.
He hands Amit an envelope. As he does so, the other man fixes his eyes on the boy and says, perhaps in jest, perhaps not,
You better make sure you really do end up being as good at hockey as everyone thinks.
When the Saab's engine starts up again and the men disappear into the night, Amit looks down into the envelope. Inside it are 5 crumpled 1,000-kroner notes. It's hard to know who you can trust in Beartown. The man in the black jacket who's driving the Saab knows that as well as anyone else. So he judges people by what he can see. He saw Kevin's dad go to the Hollow and give Amit enough money to pay his mom's rent that month. And he saw the boy throw it in the snow. He saw the same boy stand up at the meeting in front of the whole town, with everything to lose, without wavering. And he saw the boy tonight, when he knew he was going to be attacked. He didn't run. He stood out here and waited. The man in the black jacket doesn't know if that's enough to trust someone, but the only person in the world he really trusts is Ramona, and he's only tried to lie to her once. He was a teenager. She asked if he'd found a lost wallet on the pool table. He said no. And she called him out on it instantly. When he asked her how she knew, she hit him in the head with a broom handle and roared, Stupid boy, I own a fucking bar. Don't you think I've had a bit of experience when it comes to working out if men are lying or not? Perhaps one day the man in the black jacket will think about this too. Why he only wondered if it was Kevin or Amit who was telling the truth. Why Maya's word wasn't enough.
Bang. Bang. Bang.
In a rehearsal room in Head, a boy puts down an instrument to open a door that someone has just knocked on. Benji is standing outside, leaning on his crutches, with a pair of skates in his hand. The bass player bursts out laughing. They go to a small outdoor rink behind Head's indoor rink. Benji has better balance on his crutches than the bass player has on the skates. They kiss each other for the first time on that ice.
Bang.
2 girls are walking through a pitch-black forest. They stop in a clearing and switch their flashlights on, do their secret handshake, swear loyalty to each other. Then they each raise a shotgun and fire shot after shot out across the lake.
Bang.
In the rink in Beartown, a father stands at the center circle, stares down at the bear painted on it. When he was really small, his first day in skating class, he was terrified of that bear. Sometimes he still is.
Bang. Bang. Bang.
Chapter 46. Another morning comes. It always does. Time always moves at the